Well, friends, it's good to be back with you again this week. I had a lot of fun last week before I went home and watched the football. I had a lot of fun with you. I noticed actually that my friends who normally rag me and send me all sorts of really terrible things about my football team haven't done that this week. I think they're looking at it and going, this is so bad, we actually can't speak to Stephen about this right now. But we're going to talk about something much more uplifting than that. We're going to talk about the Christian faith. Just to set the scene again, what I've been doing is I'm basically sharing with you how I myself, in my own head, emotionally, intellectually, wrestle with the Christian faith. I lead a church in the city center of Cape Town where I am constantly, almost, well, literally every week, engaging predominantly with young secular folk who have either walked away from the faith or are not coming towards anywhere near a church because of emotional or intellectual objections. And so I have these discussions week in and week out with these folk. And as I'm having these discussions, I'm going back, okay, well, why do I actually believe this stuff? Why am I still at this? Why am I still following Christ? And so that's what these series of talks is about. I'm going to pray quickly, just ask God for some help, and then we'll dive into our topic for this evening. Lord God, I want to thank you that you are a God who has spoken comprehensively about this world. If we read the scriptures from beginning to end, we see that there's such an enormous range of topics that you touch on, that you deal with in the Bible. And so we're able to then take our lives and we're able to evaluate them, the experience of our life, alongside the scriptures, Lord. And I'm grateful for the way in which in my own life those two things have come together. I pray as we look tonight at that same subject, you might bring those two things together for each one of us. And I ask that in Jesus' holy name. Amen. Last week I mentioned a quote from the Oxford teacher and writer, Christian writer C.S. Lewis. I said that he once said this. He said, I believe in Christianity as I believe that the sun has risen, not only because I see it, but because by it I see everything else. And when I first read that quote, when I first came across that quote, it really resonated with me. And I said, yes, that's why I believe. That is why I believe in Christianity. You see, he's essentially saying that it's not just about seeing an individual act and then saying, well, because I witnessed that one act, therefore I believe now in Christianity. That would be the basis for belief. Some of the stuff we actually looked at last week. A confirmation of that basis, however, would be to look at the world around you, to reflect on the way that you experience the world, and then to look and see that it's largely the same as the way the Bible describes human experience. So that's what C.S. Lewis is saying there. He's saying, when I look at what God has said about the world in the Bible, when I look at my own experience, a whole lot of things come together, they converge, that make me think then that what God is saying in the Bible must be true. And for me, that's exactly how I feel on a lot of counts. I know for a lot of people this is really important because you want your faith not simply to be some sort of abstract truth, but to be something that you experience as truth daily, weekly, monthly. When I travel overseas, I've got to travel quite a bit in the last few years. When I travel overseas and I have to rent a car, I really, really, really hate being a slave to the GPS. So when you're in a new place and you don't know the place at all, there's nothing you can do other than follow the GPS. And I've on occasion turned it on and it's been in Spanish and I'm like, okay, now I don't know what to do. But I really don't enjoy that experience of being a slave where if the GPS goes off the blink, I'm just lost. So what I now do is I go and I get on Google Maps, and before I'm going to go to a new city, I try and get in my mind's eye a view of the city. Not every single road and street, but just a general idea. These areas over here, the area I've got to be is over here. And if I go this way, I'll probably hit a main road there. And that way, when I'm driving around the city, if I somehow lose the GPS, I kind of know if I head that way, I'll get into the downtown, and then I'll be able to find someone who can tell me where I need to go. Now, when I do that, I'm trying to get a view of the map. If it's a good map, like Google Maps, then my experience of driving on the road, as I've got that picture in my head of what the map says, lines up with the map and what I saw in the map. If it's a bad map, so like one of those maps that your friend draws on a wedding invitation to the venue afterwards which like just go down here and then turn left and then turn right, and it's not completely out of scale. The north-south orientation is off. And so as you're driving on the road, you're like, this looks nothing like the map. I have no idea where I am. Then you're completely lost and everything is out of sync. The map is out of sync with your experience of driving on the road. Now, I have found Christianity to be a great map for me. When I look at the map of the Bible, when I look at my life, it really feels to me like those two things are coming from the same source, God. And so I want to talk this evening about three areas of the human experience, of my experience, where I see this convergence taking place. Human purpose, human morality, and human nature. Tonight might get a little bit philosophical and complicated. I'm going to try and uncomplicate it as much as I can, so stick with me on this. So here's the first one, human purpose. People have, I think, for centuries sensed that we as humans have purpose, that we're not ultimately just the product of random events, but we have design. There's a goal to existence. We use words like destiny in common language to suggest that there's some sort of purpose, some sort of story that we're kind of all fitting into. And so rightly or wrongly, we all feel that way at least. And it's a pretty ancient feeling. So if you go back and you read really ancient writers like Socrates and Plato and Aristotle, they all voice this idea that surely life has some sort of meaning. And it's an idea that we find in the Bible. Psalm 139 verses 13 to 16 says this. It says, "For you created my inmost being. You knit me together in my mother's womb. I praise you because I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Your works are wonderful. I know that full well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in the secret place, when I was woven together in the depths of the earth. Your eyes saw my unformed body. All the days ordained for me were written in your book before one of them came to be." So God has made you. He's shaped your environment with deep purpose and with deep meaning. Now this is an occasion then obviously where I'm looking at the Bible and I'm looking at the map of the Bible. I'm looking at the map of my heart and my experience of this world, and I'm saying, well, yes, they line up. I feel like there's purpose and meaning to my existence, and the Bible says that there's purpose and there's meaning to my existence. Now, the critical part of me comes along and says, okay, well, let's test this out a little bit. Let's play devil's advocate for a second here. What if there is no purpose in this universe? What if it is all just random? What if we are basically deluding ourselves into thinking that there is purpose in order to make ourselves feel better, just to kind of get over the bumps of life? Maybe we're all just narcissists, really. And so we like to think that the world revolves around us and that we're part of some bigger, greater story, but we're actually not. Now, there are people who've explored ideas like this. Probably the most famous person to go down this road was the atheist philosopher Bertrand Russell. So Russell famously said this. He once said that man is the product of causes which had no prevision of the end they were achieving, that his origin, his growth, his hopes and his fears, his loves and his beliefs are but the outcome of accidental collocations of atoms, that no fire, no heroism, no intensity of thought and feeling can preserve an individual life beyond the grave, that all the labors of the ages, all the devotion, all the inspiration, all the noonday brightness of human genius are destined to extinction in the vast death of the solar system, and that the whole temple of man's achievement must inevitably be buried beneath the debris of a universe in ruins. All of these things, if not quite beyond dispute, are yet so nearly certain that no philosophy which rejects them can hope to stand. Only within the scaffolding of these truths, only on the firm foundation of unyielding despair, can the soul's salvation henceforth be safely built. So he says, give it up. Give it all up. Your life does not have meaning. It is completely random. It is completely purposeless. One day you will cease to exist and no one will care. One day the sun is going to burn up this planet and nobody will care. And the only way then to really make sense of your life is to embrace this reality, first of all, he says, that you are nothing, that you're trash, essentially. Samuel Beckett is the playwright who wrote Waiting for Godot, that play that we all debate about how you're supposed to pronounce the last word in it. He wrote another play, a very short little play, 35 seconds long, called Breath, that essentially captures Bertrand Russell's ideas. So how the play goes, I've never seen it live, but I've seen a version of it on YouTube. How it goes is the stage is in darkness. As you come in, you hear a baby's cry, and then the lights slowly start to come on, And you hear slow breathing constantly going throughout the play. And as the lights come on and you finally get to see what's actually on the stage, you see that the stage is just littered with trash, with rubbish, refuse. And then the lights start to dim with the breathing still going. And then you hear a death cry. And that is the end of the play, at which point you ask for your money back because you just spent good money on 35 seconds of that. Now, obviously, there's a lot of debate about what exactly the play means, but I think the simplest and the most obvious suggestion is that Beckett is saying life is trash. Life is trash. Life is meaningless. It's a visual representation of all of Bertrand Russell's thinking. You and I are trash, and the universe provides no evidence to the contrary of that fact. If there is no God, friends, then you are trash. Then there is no objective purpose to your life. Your life is meaningless. You have no innate value or significance. No matter what you do with your life, it will not, in an objective sense, matter. So you'll be forced then to create subjective meaning for yourself, in which case all significance at one level is subjective. And so at one level, it's pointless celebrating other people's achievements. It's pointless feeling depressed about your own lack of achievement. Who cares? Who cares if people think you're a loser or a winner? It's all subjective anyway. Now, it's one thing to own that philosophically. It's another thing to live by that consistently. In fact, people who stop caring about what other people think of them, those are the sort of people we commit to institutions and we try to get help for them because we intrinsically believe that human beings are not supposed to be like that. And if we believe human beings are not supposed to be like that, then we do positively believe human beings are supposed to be like something. And hence, each one of us in our gut believes in human purpose. Without God, that gut feeling is a lie that we're all feeding ourselves. See, that's probably my biggest problem with Bertrand Russell's idea, is that nobody really lives it out consistently. Nobody. I have another problem, though, and that is I'm not completely persuaded that the universe has, like Russell says, left us without any evidence of purpose and design to our lives. So Alistair McGraw is an extremely smart person. He's a scientist. He's a theologian. He teaches science and theology at Oxford. I don't know how you do that. You teach two disciplines that are like miles apart from each other. He wrote a book called Mere Apologetics a couple of years ago. And in that book, he lists six clues that God exists. And these are what could be described as observable clues. In other words, these are not things that are dependent upon direct revelation from God in the Bible. You can get these things without reading a Bible or without having a miracle vision of God or something like that. The second clue he mentions is what he calls the fine-tuning of the universe. Now, when Bertrand Russell came up with this theory, he believed at the time that the universe was in a constant state of flux, that it always was and it always will be. Since Bertrand Russell, there's been near universal consensus in the scientific community that the universe actually, in fact, had a beginning. And so we have theories like the Big Bang Theory. And so we now know that there was a beginning and that there is a complex set of fine-tuned laws, like gravity, for example, that propel the universe forward into an ever-expanding future. Now, what McGraw does is he points out in his book, with the help of other scientists, that those laws are so fine-tuned and the numbers that make up those laws are so fine-tuned that even the slightest deviation in those numbers would mean no stars, no life, and certainly no developed human civilization and no people sitting and gathering on a Sunday night to talk about the bigger meaning in life. And so you've got to look at that and you've got to go, well, is that coincidence? Or is that a providential God superintending over a process? One philosopher, Alvin Plantinga, says it's kind of like playing poker with a guy. And in the first hand, he puts down four aces. And you think, wow, that was pretty good going. Second hand, he puts down four aces. Third hand, he puts down four aces. Five, fifth, sixth, seventh, 25th hand, he puts down four aces. And after a while, you're sitting going, you know what, this is probably possible, I suppose. But something else is going on here. It's like an infinite number of monkeys typing on a computer. It's like a monkey typing on a computer and out comes the complete work of Shakespeare with all the punctuation in place. Now, I know there's a counter to this. I know that your cosmologists and physicists that come along and say, well, what happens if there are multiple universes that exist today, and we just happen to be in that one observable universe where things have worked out the way that they've worked out? And I used to dismiss that idea altogether. I used to think it was a load of nonsense until a really smart guy with a PhD in my congregation who teaches at UCT came to me and said, well, Stephen, actually, we need to talk about this because there's a lot of good theories behind the multiverse theory that make a lot of sense, at least in principle. And so I've wrestled with it and I've looked at it. And so there you've got a situation where you essentially do maybe have an infinite number of monkeys sitting typing at computer screens, and one of them happens to, in the end, because there are so many of them, end up writing the full complete works of Shakespeare with all the punctuation in place. So I've wrestled with that idea, and there are a bunch of different comebacks to that. In fact, there are a bunch of scholars who actually argue that the multiverse actually proves God more than disproves God if it is real. But I came across this from science writer John Horgan, his thoughts on this particular subject about a year or two ago. He's an agnostic. He's not a Christian. Although he fervently believes, as I do, that science and religion are not at odds with each other and that they are, in fact, perfectly compatible. But on this whole issue of cosmology and the multiverse theory, he actually writes this. He says, cosmologists are more baffled than ever at why there is something rather than nothing. And multiverse theories are about as testable as religious beliefs. So they don't really get us anywhere closer to figuring out why there is something rather than nothing. Now, after looking at all of this sort of stuff, this complicated stuff that gives me a headache, inside my heart, it starts to say to me, it sure feels like I have purpose in this universe. And the fine-tuned universe is awfully suggestive that that's not just a subjective opinion on my part. It's not just something I woke up with one day and decided I felt like I had purpose. And so I find God's take on the universe and my take on the universe coming together. I find the pieces fit together. And it is so, so important for us, I think, that the pieces do come together, not because of abstract science and philosophy, but because if there really is purpose with which God created us, then you really are fearfully and wonderfully made. You really are. Then your life really, really has meaning. You really have value. Your achievements really matter. Your celebrations really matter. Your victories, your joys are real. Your passions, your hopes, your desires, they're all genuine then. Your enjoyment of this life, your reveling in it, your making the most of it has deep significance. I don't know about you, but I want to live in that world rather than on the precipice of unyielding despair, as Bertrand Russell calls it. That's the first one. Now, another big area where, in my own experience, I found the pieces coming together is the area of human morality. What is right? What is wrong? Immanuel Kant, the German philosopher, once rather boldly stated that if you want to believe in moral normativity, kind of objective morality, then you have to believe in God, he said. Richard Dawkins, the famous atheist, who doesn't really seem to like Christians a whole lot, He has said basically the same thing in his book, The God Delusion, and in interviews and debates. So when you look around and you realize that there's a lot of morality that you and I hold to out there that certainly looks normative, then you've got to wonder, where does that come from? For example, and I'm going to try and use extreme examples here just to try and make the point clear, but the rape of a child, regardless of cultural norms, I hope we would all say is always wrong. We'd always agree on that. Even if a new world order came to power and brainwashed us into thinking that the rape of a child was a good thing, we would still say, no, that is objectively wrong. Even if through some very sort of sophisticated reasoning, the world came together and decided that it would be to the benefit of overall human flourishing, which seems to be the goal of most morality nowadays, if occasionally the rape of a child was permitted, we would still say, no, that is objectively wrong. There can be no circumstance when it would be morally acceptable. We'd all agree on that, I hope. No amens at that point. Come on, people. So the question then is, where does this universal agreement come from? Now, I can only plausibly see two options. Option number one is God. Psalm 19, verses 7 to 10 says this, "The law of the Lord is perfect, refreshing the soul. The statutes of the Lord are trustworthy, making wise the simple. The precepts of the Lord are right, giving joy to the heart. The commands of the Lord are radiant, giving light to the eyes. The fear of the Lord is pure, enduring forever. The decrees of the Lord are firm, And all of them are righteous. They are more precious than gold, than much pure gold. They are sweeter than honey from the honeycomb. So option one is that God has written some sort of moral law, this beautiful moral law, into the fabric of this universe and even into the fabric of our own being, so that the Apostle Paul can actually say later on in the New Testament, in Romans chapter 2, that even our consciences, apart from having read the Bible, alert us to the reality of this existing moral law. So that's option one. It comes from God. Option two is that it's an evolutionary trait. So the only other option I could reasonably entertain, and this is the option maintained by most secularists and atheists, is that our morality as humans is simply an evolutionary trait that aids us in the survival of the fittest or the propagating of our selfish genes. In other words, the reason we all think that it's always bad to rape a child is because the raping of a child would be bad for the development of our species. And so it's kind of built in there. And so our morality is completely then conditioned by nature. Now, I was thinking about this, and the thing that struck me was that regardless of which option you tend to pick, we still always end up using the language of good and bad, right and wrong. And so I queried, well, where is that coming from? Let's take a step even further back. Where is that coming from? So, for example, secularists will talk about the evolutionary process, and they'll say something like, well, we don't endorse murder. And the reason we don't endorse murder is that murder would not be beneficial for the survival of the species. In other words, it would not be good for us. Which means even at that level, evolutionary theory has a set of moral values of its own. It goes like this. Survival equals good or desirable. Extinction equals bad or undesirable. Now stick with me here for a second. If everything is random, as evolutionary theory states, if there is no purpose, if there's no meaning behind the process, then how can we ever, ever possibly label one thing as good and another thing as bad? It doesn't make sense. It seems to me to be an act of absurdity to then say, well, this is good and this is bad. Why isn't extinction good and survival bad? In this quagmire of randomness, devoid of purpose, devoid of morality, devoid of design, we take one thing out and we say, no, this is good. And we take another thing out and we say, this is bad. That sounds absurd to me. That's not the only reason I object to morality being only conditioned by nature. The other big problem I have as I look at this is where morality conditioned by nature can, by nature alone, can lead us. And this part really scares me. Right now, there are things that we think are wrong and should always be wrong. But if we follow this rabbit all the way down the rabbit hole, then provided we're not endangering the species, which is kind of the golden rule of evolutionary theory, anything goes. Here's a very charming example of what I mean. It's generally agreed upon that bestiality is a disgusting and immoral practice. Now, that should get the loudest amen. But not so under a purely naturalistic view of morality. Peter Singer is a professor in ethics and moral philosophy at Princeton. He is highly regarded as one of the leading moral ethicists in the world today. In fact, our entire next generation of moral theorists and that are basically learning at the feet of Peter Singer. He's about as high up as you can get in that particular discipline, in that field. And he is wonderfully entertaining. If you go and watch his TED Talks or you watch YouTube videos, he's exceptionally smart. He's an Australian, so we forgive him for that. But he's brilliant. I enjoy listening to him. His credentials are impeccable as a scholar. But he thinks we should dismiss the taboo that surrounds sexual contact with animals. In 2001, he wrote an article entitled Heavy Petting, in which he concluded that sexual... You're allowed to laugh at that in the church. It's all right. In which he concluded that sexual contact across the species barrier should cease to be, and I quote, cease to be an offense to our status and dignity as human beings. Unless you think that bestiality would be exploitive of animals and endanger them, know that Peter Singer is one of the leading voices in the world for animal rights. He champions veganism. He violently opposes the exploitation of animals. You might remember when we had the stem cell burger that was created without having to kill any animals. He was one of the guys who was behind that project to create meat without having to endanger animal lives. And so in his article, what he does is he actually outlines a few ways in which sexual contact could take place with an animal where neither party is exploited. So that is to say that one of the leading mainstream respected academics in the world in the area of moral philosophy and ethics thinks that you should get over the taboo that surrounds bestiality because there is actually nothing really that immoral about it. Now, Singer actually gets a little bit more extreme than that, because he's made a case for forms of human infanticide that have also been very controversial. In another article, he wrote this, and I quote, he said, "The fact that a being is a human being, in the sense of a member of the species Homo sapiens, is not relevant to the wrongness of killing it. It is rather characteristics like rationality, autonomy, and self-consciousness that make a difference. Infants lack these characteristics. Killing them, therefore, cannot be equated with killing normal human beings or any other self-conscious beings. No infant, disabled or not, has as strong a claim to life as beings capable of seeing themselves as distinct entities existing over time." So Peter Singer is saying that an infant has less of a claim to life, ethically speaking, than an animal that in its present state is more advanced than the infant in characteristics like rationality, autonomy, and self-consciousness. I remember when my 5-year-old daughter was 2 weeks old, she did 3 things. She ate, she slept, and she pooped. There are a lot of animals in this world that are a little bit more advanced than that right now. That is a utilitarian morality based solely upon a naturalistic world. That's where it goes. That's where it leads us, sleeping with dogs and killing babies. And I don't actually think Peter Singer is trying to be immoral. I genuinely think Peter Singer at his heart of hearts is trying to be as moral as he possibly can for the good of this world. And Peter Singer is not the exception to the rule either. I recently heard very famous atheist Lawrence Krauss, one of the foremost cosmologists in this world, in a debate with a Christian minister in Australia, he actually said, "We cannot have any moral qualms about incest, provided that reproduction is taken out of the equation." According to him, we cannot call a non-reproductive romantic relationship between a brother and a sister immoral because naturalism gives us no grounds for making that moral claim. It just doesn't. Here in Cape Town, we have examples of naturalistic utilitarian ethics and morality. David Benatar, I think he's still the head of the School of Philosophy here at UCT. He believes, and he's written pretty extensively on this subject, that we should bring about the extinction of the human race by not having more children. See, he believes that subjecting any creature to pain is immoral. All creatures in this world experience some measure of pain, and you have no control over how much pain your child is going to experience. Therefore, to bring a new creature into this world is to do harm to that creature. Therefore, we should stop having babies, and we should let the human race die out so that no one will ever be subjected to pain again. It's called voluntary human extinction. It actually has quite a big following around the world. Now, those are just some of the examples of where a purely naturalistic, utilitarian explanation for morality takes us. Here is, the one big spoke in the wheel of the naturalists, and that is that we as human beings do multiple moral things that simply do not have their basis in evolutionary theory or naturalism. And I could give you a lot of examples here, but just one that stands out among the rest is the problem of altruism. Altruism is the act of doing good to someone else at personal cost and without any possibility of benefit. We know that altruism exists among humans, and yet evolutionary biologists cannot really find a natural basis for it. The kind of altruism that exists between human beings does not exist among other species. There are some forms of reciprocal altruism that exist among some animals, but it's very, very different from the conscious, premeditated altruism that we find between human beings. Francis Collins, a very decorated scientist, he was the head of the Genome Project. He's also a very committed Christian. And one of the reasons he cites for his own personal belief in God is the existence of altruism among humans. You see, as far as he's concerned, when he sees altruism there, he says that simply screams out that there is a moral force behind all that we see and do. And evolutionary theory cannot fully account for that objective morality. Let me give you just one more personal example before we move to the final point. When my daughter was 2 weeks old, I used to go into the bedroom, into her bedroom where her cot was, and she'd be lying there. And I'd stand over the cot, and I'd look into that cot, and I'd see this tiny little creature And I was the sort of person who, before I had children, I wasn't really sure if I wanted children. I was like, my wife wants children, and I think it's probably a good thing to have children. It'll probably be good for me in the long run. But like, what if I don't love my child? I literally had that fear. And the minute she was born, my entire world just changed completely. And I was like, how did I live without her? And I was standing there, and I was standing in the cot, and I'd look down at her, and I'd have this overwhelming sense of love for this tiny little creature wrapped up there sleeping, most of the time sleeping. Enormous, enormous love. Now, if I go along with Peter Singer and co, then there's actually no objective value to that love that I feel. It's not really real. It's simply an evolutionary mechanism at play to make me not kill my daughter, actually. Now, friends, I can't live in that world where my love for my daughter is only a chemical reaction, a piece of biology. I want to live in a world where it is more than that. And God says to me in the Bible, Stephen, your gut instincts are right about that. There is more to it than that. Because I have written my love onto the very fabric of this universe, and I have written my love onto the very fabric of the human heart. And so when I read the Bible, the pieces come together again for me. Now, last one, and quickly, human nature. I'm very aware, and this might come as a shock to some of you, that I don't just have feelings of love and altruism towards all people all the time. I'm very aware that I'm often very selfish, and I have very destructive feelings inside of me, and those feelings often manifest themselves in rather bad behavior. I'm also aware that for the most part, these impulses or feelings feel a little bit out of my control. I can restrain them a little bit, but by and large, I feel more like I'm subject to them. And so I go to the Bible to find out why this is, and I come to Romans chapter 5 and verse 12. Now, this is a bit of a complicated part of Romans. When we preached through Romans recently, I gave it to my staff member to preach, just so I didn't have to do it. But listen to these words. Therefore, just as sin entered the world through one man, and death through sin, and in this way death came to all people because all sinned, to be sure, sin was in the world before the law was given, but sin is not charged against anyone's account where there is no law. Nevertheless, death reigned from the time of Adam to the time of Moses, even over those who did not sin by breaking a command, as did Adam, who is a pattern of the one to come. But the gift is not like the trespass, for if the many died by the trespass of the one man, how much more did God's grace and the gift that came by the grace of the one man, Jesus Christ, overflow to the many? Nor can the gift of God be compared with the result of one man's sin. The judgment followed one sin and brought condemnation, but the gift followed many trespasses and brought justification. For if by the trespass of the one man death reigned through that one man, how much more will those who receive God's abundant provision of grace and of the gift of righteousness reign in life through the one man, Jesus Christ? Consequently, just as one trespass resulted in condemnation for all people, so also one righteous act resulted in justification and life for all people. For just as through the disobedience of the one man, the many were made sinners, so also through the obedience of the one man, the many will be made righteous. I think a lot of people would like to have the Apostle Paul as their pastor, but I don't think you realize just how repetitive he is sometimes. The Bible teaches that all people are born into Adam, it says there in Romans 5. That is, into a state of sinfulness. That original sin of Adam has tainted our very natures so that we are deemed sinners. Now, you can just imagine this is not one of Christianity's more popular doctrines. People are not flocking to churches to hear about this part particularly. The Protestant reformers came along and they talked about the total depravity of humankind. Now, that doesn't mean that we're all as evil as we possibly could be, but it does mean that every single part of our being is tainted by sin, even the good things that we do. Again, not a particularly popular, uplifting, life-giving doctrine. But, and here is the big but for me, the doctrine of total depravity completely makes sense of my own inner experience. It completely explains to me why I feel like things like pride and selfishness are such stubborn impulses in me that just refuse to go away. It explains to me why, even though I have good intentions towards people, I often never follow through on them. I never turn that into action. It explains to me why good people do bad things. It explains to me why ordinary people do horrific things. And so as I open up the Bible and I look inside at the doctrine of total depravity, I again get the sense that the pieces are coming together. Now, friends, the amazing news of the gospel, the central message of the Christian faith, is that it doesn't end there. And we actually read it in Romans 5. It doesn't end there. God doesn't just come along and provide us with a comprehensive worldview and say, look, this is how you work and this is how the world works, so that we can make sense of purpose and morality and human nature. He does more than that. He actually comes and he rescues us. He rescues us out of that purposeless, amoral mess that we often find ourselves in. And again, it's actually altruism that makes all the difference here. In verse 18 of chapter 5, Paul talks about the one act of righteousness that brings justification. That one act he's talking about is actually the moment of the purest altruism that this world has ever seen. That moment when the King of the universe, Jesus Christ, at enormous personal cost to himself, gave his life for an undeserving, sinful race of human beings, Adam's race, you and me. You want to know where the pieces really, really come together for me? It's that inside of me, there's a part of me that says altruism and true altruism is the highest, most noble point that any human being can reach. Think about it. Think about your best movies. Nothing moves our hearts quite like true altruism in the plot line. When a man jumps onto train tracks in front of a speeding train to pull off another man who's having seizures, we are filled with awe at that person's heroism, their bravery, their selflessness. When a college professor blocks the door of his classroom, as happened at Virginia Tech, and he uses his own body as a human shield against gunmen so that his students can climb out the window, we're overcome with a sense of deep, deep appreciation, unbelieving appreciation that a human being would do that. That sacrifice, that selflessness. Is it any surprise then that at the center of world history and at the center of the Bible is our Lord and our God, Jesus Christ, using his body as a human shield to save us from the speeding train of sin, despair, darkness, and even death in the greatest act of altruism ever? When you look at that picture and you see that that's at the core of the Christian faith, doesn't it just start to feel for you like the pieces come together? It does for me. Let me pray for us. Father, I am so thankful for the wonderful scope of your word. I am so thankful that the middle of that scope, when everything zooms down, we find Jesus Christ. We find him giving his life for us sacrificially. We find him standing in the firing line for us. Though we are in Adam, though our sin manifests itself in all sorts of destructive ways, you would love us enough to intervene. You would love us enough to break us out of that. We are eternally thankful for that, Lord. As we wrestle with all these things, Lord, might we be conscious of Jesus Christ and his sacrifice for us. Amen.